Bill. Before we jump into this, I just want to, just a word to help us. Sometimes, we don't like to admit this, but sometimes we become very cynical. Troubles and difficulties abound. The mess that we live in doesn't go away. And before long, we, even Christians, take the position that there's nothing we can do about it and that prayer matters little. So I want to guard our hearts. Many people, many Christians, find themselves in places that are that they should identify with Habakkuk. And Habakkuk, as we've already read, if you came here this morning hoping that when you came to hear the Word of God, it would just pat you on the back and say, you are doing well. Well, this isn't that text. And so this morning, we are not going to get a pat on the back and saying you're doing well so much as it's going to be introducing us to a book that I hope will stretch us to see something about God that we have not previously seen. And that as we're stretched to see, it provides hope for us, not cynicism. So if you already know about yourself, and I can get there myself, if you already know you're struggling with cynicism about the way that the world is and all the rest, friends, guard your hearts and look to the promises of God. Look at what he's telling us and take heart. The key verse of this book is found in chapter 2, verse 4. The righteous will live by faith. And we're going to draw every sermon that direction. So with that in mind, and I think that's probably all that needs to be said, we look now to the text. As I've already said, in recent years, as I look around the world and as I look at news reports and as you join me in that, it is not a stretch at all from time to time, nearly every week, to say to myself, the world has gone mad and I'm the only one that knows it. Now, some of you know it too because you've shared these things with me, but it looks like when we look around, does nobody know how irrational that is? Well, that's the world that we're living in. There seems to be no end whatsoever to the national and international incidents that confirm those conclusions. If you are one of those, like myself, that listens to Al Mohler in the morning, start off your day well. On the way in from Summers, I get to listen to Uncle Al, as he is affectionately known, tell me how the world has gone mad while I was asleep. And I hear him tell me things that I would have said, there's no way any leadership in the world is actually thinking that way. But he assures me that that is true. And tomorrow, you'll get another one from some other country, maybe our own, that will stretch your imagination to know, how can educated people think that that is good for society? Well, those are the days we're living in. Almost every week, we are reminded that the world has gone completely crazy. There is an occurrence nearly weekly where we're introduced to some new sexual scandal from a high-profile leader, and then, just to show how irrational everything really is, some resign under a cloud of negative press, others don't resign, and then within a week, nobody cares. That is irrational. It's madness. The institutions that are meant to protect our freedoms are being regularly exposed before our eyes. They are guilty of the grossest forms of hypocrisy or carelessness, one of the two. And they further damage each of these episodes, further damage the confidence that we have both in the institutions and the people who lead them. And it leaves you scratching your head saying, how in the world? As a nation, we're still embroiled in racial tensions that have led to suspicion and accusation and even hostility between the races. We still have troubles with poverty. We don't know what to do with it. We still live in a place in the Flathead that is squashing the poor and squeezing the middle. It's a hard place to live. We live in a country that still uses intimidation and manipulation to get their way, and we still feel that it is our personal right to destroy the unborn. And that leaves us scratching our heads. In the church, like the broader culture, we don't really love authority. We don't really love accountability. And we don't really like to depend on God for things that we could clearly do ourselves. The health and welfare gospel continues to attract enormous crowds in our country, preaching a gospel that promises you influence and affluence and prosperity and your best life now on this earth. Who would want it? Few of us have not lived in a community in which a pastor's moral failure is still not resonating in the minds of those locals, still a recent memory. I've been in several of them myself. And our family goes into a community as a pastor, and we are met with a whole bunch of suspicion and cynicism because of the guy that was there before. We look around, we see a church that has largely forgotten that its greatest problem that the world is facing is that we stand in judgment of a holy God. And we have confused ourselves into thinking that the greatest message that has ever entered into the human ears is how you can be rich instead of how you can be free. That's the church. And I wonder how many of you have consciously taken note of the madness in the past month or even the past week. A couple of days from now, America will cast their votes at the midterm elections. Political candidates have been reminding us for months of what a mess we live in, whose fault it is, and who you can count on to fix it. That's why I said, don't become so cynical. At the center of all of the rhetoric, at the center of all the mudslinging that's taken place over the course of a year or more, here's what you find, is that everyone is in agreement. We are living in a mess. Well, if you understand that kind of frustration, you will identify with this prophet Habakkuk. Because when he looked out over his world, when he looked out over his community and within Israel, he noticed all the injustices committed by God's people, and he was wearied by it. He was heavily wearied by the burden of the atrocity of the moral and spiritual condition of the culture in which he lived. So Habakkuk, like us, was weary of the world as it is. I don't know very many Christians that aren't. And the weariness moved him. It moved him to make an appeal to God. And the appeal to God was, oh God, don't you care? Oh God, won't you do something? That's at least my take on what he says. How long shall I cry for help and you will not hear me? How long will I cry violence and you will not save? I think a good summary. Why don't you care? And can't you do something? Let me give you a little bit of background since we're just introducing the book this morning. This is a four-week study in one of the minor prophets by the name of Habakkuk. And he's called a minor prophet, not because it's unimportant, but because it's brief. And Habakkuk is a person that we know absolutely nothing about except for what we find of him here. And yet, I think there's enough here that we can identify with Habakkuk quite a little bit. It's a book that's organized around a prophet's interactions with God, and it's chiefly around two questions that he asks of God and then God responds. Two cycles of questioning God and then hearing the response, and then chapter 3 is his response to the responses. And so it's a pretty simple outline, really, of the book. But what Habakkuk's chief concern is the moral and spiritual mess that he lives in. And he wants to know what God's going to do about it. And that's really the point of this entire book. By the time Habakkuk writes it, however, Habakkuk has been eyewitness to the moral and spiritual decline in Judah. It developed chiefly during the reigns of Manasseh, a very evil king, and Amon, his son. That's recorded in 2 Kings chapter 23. And under their leadership, Judah experienced the normalization of the worship of Baal in the community up on the high places. They began offering their children to Molech. They dedicated horses to the sun god, and they allowed the temple to fall into ruins. Now, this temple, if you're not familiar with the Old Testament, is the place that God promised to place his name. It was the earthly representation of his presence, and they allowed it through neglect to just come to ruin. Priesthood was no longer functioning, the sacrificial system was no longer happening. And human beings who were given a promise under Abraham that they would be the apple of God's eye turned away from God during this period of spiritual decline. It is significant, following Manasseh and Amon, that a good king, Josiah, came to the throne in Judah and turned the country back as the word of God was discovered And in this temple of ruins, they find the Word of God. He begins cherishing it with all of his heart. He puts into practice some reforms, but it's short-lived and it's very temporary, in spite of the fact that the temple was reestablished, the priesthood was brought back to work, and the Feast of Passover was reestablished. But soon after Josiah's death, Judah turned away again to its evil ways. And this is probably a decade or so before Habakkuk writes. Politically, you might also know that Assyria had taken control of Israel and Judah for over 100 years. They had inflicted great punishment. They have exacted great amounts of tribute from them. But now the winds of change are beginning to blow. And the prophet comes with the question, "How long, O Lord?" That's the first point. How long, O Lord? This otherwise unknown prophet looks around and he piles up synonyms to describe what injustices he sees as he looks at his world. He uses words like this: iniquity, wrong, destruction, violence. He tells us that strife and contention are on the rise within the people. And he says, and it's because the law has been ignored that the power of the law is paralyzed, so that in verses 3 and 4 he says, "Justice never goes forth, for the wicked surround the righteous, and the justice goes forth perverted." That's his world. Justice goes forth perverted because God's people have refused to live by and according to God's law. And so the prophet asks, "How long, O Lord? How long?" It's not a question asking God for more information, and it's not a question that's trying to get from God a certain timetable. He's simply deeply moved. It is a statement. It is a personal appeal to God to intervene. "How long, O God, will you just stand by and watch? How long will I cry for help? How long will I cry out to you? Violence, and you do not save, and you do not appear to hear." The law has been ignored, and now the righteous are being oppressed. You see, the law was supposed to be the basis by which the healthy society and the life of the Jew was to be lived. It was justice that the law, the justice of the law, that was to be the envy of the world around them. Listen to the words of Moses in Deuteronomy 4. This is what Moses says about the law and its benefit to the Jewish people. He says, "For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, whenever we call upon Him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all the law that I set before you today?" Moses was not in any way shrinking back in kind of some embarrassment about the law. He says, man, this is the greatest gig going on. The nations of the world are going to look upon the way that we do life and the way that we handle crime and the way that we deal with each other. And the nations are going to be envious of us. And it's because of that reason that just a couple of verses later in Deuteronomy 4, Moses gives this exhortation to the people to keep it and teach it and to live by it. He says, so take care, keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. Make them known to your children and your children's children. Don't forsake the law. And yet they have. The law was supposed to define them, and they have ignored it. And justice isn't flowing. Just a pathetic perversion of justice now flows. Because the people have forgotten who they are, they have forgotten their privileged position, and they have forgotten the duties of faith. They have forgotten what has been summarized by the prophet Micah 6 and 8. "He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, love kindness, and to walk humbly before your God." And at this time in Habakkuk's life, the Jewish nation has completely forsaken that simple way. Justice has gone forth perverted, he says. And this is a different word picture than thinking that there is no justice in the land. It means that the justice that's there, that's called justice, is actually a perversion. It means that it's been reinvented. It means it's been redefined. It means that the standard that's used to determine such things as what is right and what is wrong, or what is acceptable and unacceptable, is no longer God who's determining them, but it is the preferences of rebellious human beings. That is what has caught Habakkuk's eye, and that's what's turning him to God. God, what are you going to do about a nation of people who ignore your righteous standards and have created their own version of it? A version, incidentally, that puts the righteous in the midst of a great oppression. They're surrounded by the wicked in the name of justice. Now Habakkuk says, what in the world are you going to do about this? They're surrounded by the wicked. The righteous are oppressed because there's nothing but a perversion of justice, because human beings have dictated what's right, wrong, acceptable, and unacceptable. This is like the days of Amos. In Amos chapter 2, 7 and 8, God says, I raised up some of your sons to be prophets, and I raised up some of your sons to be Nazarites. But you made the Nazarites drink wine, and you commanded the prophets, saying, you shall not prophesy. Now, obviously, a prophet is called to speak the words of God for God. And a Nazarite is a person who, by the unction of God, takes a vow to stay away from wine, to not cut their hair and other things, as a temporary period of time of separation and holiness. God says, I raised up some of your sons to be Nazarites, and I raised up some of your sons to be prophets, but you didn't like that. So he goes on to say, in spite of the fact that God called men to holiness, the people refused to allow those men to be holy. He called some to proclaim God's word, but the people did not let them speak. They did not want to hear the prophets, and they did not want to see examples of holiness. And so, justice is perverted. It is in the understanding of a fallen group of people. And as a result, the righteous are oppressed and surrounded. And they get the feelings of powerlessness. The rule of law is now being used against them, and the wicked seem to prosper to the detriment of the entire nation. And so Habakkuk's prayer to God is very closely related to what we find in Jeremiah chapter 12, when Jeremiah says, Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why do all who are treacherous thrive? Habakkuk's not the first one in the Bible to recognize that there's some kind of injustice here. Jeremiah saw it. Job asked a fitting question. Does not the Lord of all the earth do right? Asaph, writer of Psalm 73, I think he was a little more honest with the details here. He says, it's a confession. I was envious of the arrogant when I looked out and I saw the prosperity of the wicked. He's confessing, I actually started envying the arrogant because it looked like their life was so easy. But he goes on, he says in verse 4, for they have no pangs until death. That means no discomfort in their bodies. Their bodies, they're fat and sleek, he says. They're not in trouble as others are. They're not stricken like the rest of mankind. It seems like, in the minds of these men and their observation, it seems like the more wicked you are, the easier you have life. I want you to understand something about Habakkuk. Habakkuk's quandary is theological. It's theological. He simply knows things about God. His theological understanding of God is not matching right now what he's experiencing. And it's causing the quandary. He knows that God is just. But some reason, God is allowing injustice to flourish and the righteous to be oppressed. And that's the quandary. I wonder if we're clear on what it means that God is actually just. In the Greek and the Hebrew, the words for justice and righteousness are actually the same word. In the English, it's two different kinds of words. But in the Greek and the Hebrew, it's the same word. Just, righteous, it's the same word. It essentially means this. It means, in terms of God's justice, that God always acts according to what is right, and that He is the only sufficient standard for what is right. So, God's justice means He always acts according to what's right. Whatever he does is right. And he's the only standard to determine what is right, what is wrong, what's acceptable, and what's unacceptable. He's the only standard. That's what it means that God is just. What God is, he is perfectly. He is without fault. He is without the ability or the need for learning more about it. He is, in a perfect sense, just. That's what Habakkuk would have learned from Deuteronomy 32. God is a rock. His work is perfect. All of his ways are just. A God of faithfulness and without iniquity, just and upright is he. But what he knows about God and what he's experiencing right now are at odds. That's what provokes him to appeal to God. Don't you care? Can't you do something? Many non-Christians have concluded that the affairs of their life are of no concern to God, that he simply does not care. That regardless of what their life is like, they have concluded that God, no matter what he says, does not care. According to a recent study by Ligonier Ministries, nearly 40% of those who are 18 to 34 years old do not believe that God cares about their daily lives. 40%. But it's not only true of non-Christians, it's also true of Christians. That we have a difficulty at times merging what we know to be true about God and our circumstances that God has sovereignly allowed. Jeremiah struggled with it. Job struggled with it. Asaph struggled with it. So did David struggle with it. The psalm that I read at the beginning of our service this morning, Psalm 13. The conflict in David's heart was concerning the steadfast love of God. He knew that God's steadfast love was real. He knew it was true. He knew it was steady. He knew it was dependable. And yet he was trying to reconcile that kind of love that God has for him with his experience. Temporarily, his enemies were exulting over him. And he didn't know what to do. It was a difficult time. And it was theological as much as it was anything else. How do I make sense of this particular situation in life when I know these things to be true about God? What I want you to see in the life of David and what I want you to see in the life of Habakkuk is that God, through his revelation, is stretching us to see something of him that you would not have normally seen. David cries out to God, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me?" And friends, it is so difficult when it seems that God has turned away his notice from us. It's so difficult when it seems that our appeals to him for action just are met with silence. It's important to notice that David and Habakkuk are on the verge of despair, and it's important to notice that what they're saying about God is what appears to be true and not what is truly true about things. They are responding to the way things appear. It appears that God doesn't care. It appears that God is not there. It appears that God has turned away his face. It appears that he has left me on my own. Psalms like Psalm 139 present a case that's impossible for us to draw those conclusions. But you're right in the midst of that. When you're right in the midst of difficulty, when you're right in the midst of the thick of really hard things, it's easy for us to let our minds wander and to draw certain wrong conclusions. It's simply not true that God forgets us, but we feel like he has. It's simply not true that God hides his face away from us, but sometimes it appears that he has. And the great danger of feeling like God is nowhere to be found is told to us in Psalm 13. So David gives us a little insight into what Habakkuk is probably feeling too. And when he's crying out, "How long, how long, how long?" He says the danger here is that, "God, if you don't speak, I'm going to start counseling myself." That's what he says in verse 2. "I'm going to take counsel in my own soul, and I will have sorrow in my heart. I'm looking to you to answer, but if it just goes on long, I'm going to start listening to myself. I'll start counseling myself." When it seems that God is far away, that's what we do. We often begin listening to our own counsel. We We reason from our own despair. We draw conclusions about God from what we're experiencing instead of what He's revealed. And we begin to take our own counsel. I'm sure some of you have done the same thing. I've been there before. Probably the most persuasive counselor in my life is myself, which is both good and dangerous. Perhaps someone in your life got the diagnosis of cancer. God seemed very distant. Maybe someone in your life was taken from you at a pivotal point in your life. You cry out to God and it seemed like there was just silence. Maybe someone harmed you. Some great disappointment that you faced in life. Something went very wrong when you were persistently seeking to do something intentionally right. You cried out to God and it seemed like there was nothing there. And then you began doing what David says he doesn't want to do, but he finds himself doing. And that is you begin taking counsel in your own soul. You begin seeking out people who feel just as miserable as you do. And there, don't be surprised if you are become very persuasive in your own soul. It's vital for us to remember those great words and insights of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, who asked the question, have you ever realized that the most of your unhappiness in life is due to the fact that you are listening to yourself rather than talking to yourself? It is a truism, it's true of human beings. We seek counselors who agree with us. Sometimes the only one you can find is you and you'll take it. But sometimes you'll find others. And when the only counsel that you allow yourself to be really influenced by is one who agrees with your mood and your own troubled heart, then you are ripe for despair. Habakkuk did not take counsel in himself. He turned his attention to God. He looked to God. Even if it was in the weary and troubled of his soul, he looked to God. God, don't you care? God, can't you fix this? Point two is that God is going to fix this. A work you will not believe. And the silence of Habakkuk's monologue is broken up by a word from God that brings assurance in 1 second, and the next, that assurance is turned to dismay. Look among the nations and see, verse 5. Wonder and be astounded, he says. For I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if I told you. Ah, you can imagine how that rested on the ears of Habakkuk. Ah, something wonderful is going to happen. Something astounding. God is going to do something. He's going to act. You see what that means to the prophet? It means that God really was seeing all of this. It means that God really does care. It means that God has been grieved too. It means that He has taken notice of the oppression and the oppressors. In a moment, Habakkuk's heart was no doubt cheered. Because this is a story of a prophet. It's a story of an observant prophet who learns about God and God's ways in ways that he had not ever considered. Habakkuk's thinking in this chapter begins like a common American thought. I think Habakkuk was American. Strange name. Maybe Habakkuk is the Hebrew version for Hank. You see, Habakkuk thought that when God does act, He will all at once eliminate all the injustices and all the troubles and all the oppression in a moment. Habakkuk thought that if I just appeal to God and wait patiently for God to act, when God does act, all this mess is going to be cleared up. He was under the opinion that when God does act, He will make the weak strong, and they are in their strength, they will conquer. That is the American way. But God doesn't always work that way. The message of Habakkuk, in fact, is that more often than not, God's strength is made perfect as it works through our weakness. And our weakness remains weak even when He works through it. Let me say that again, because I struggle with this truth. In fact, what we find more often than not is that God's strength is made perfect as it works through our weakness. And our weakness remains weakness even when he works through it. That's how God works. The Apostle Paul was a prisoner, a political prisoner, when he wrote to us many of the prison epistles that we find great joy in. But he wasn't freed to write them. He wrote them as a prisoner. Johnny Erickson Tada was paralyzed as a young adult. And her writings about suffering and about what she's learned of God have taken place from a wheelchair, not after her healing. Heroes of the faith, we read about because of how they endured prisons and sufferings and weakness. And we look back on them as great examples to ourselves, not because they were miraculously delivered, but because they were so miraculously faithful. We want to read about people who experience Christ's power of His resurrection working through them. He's displaying the power of His resurrection through them, not the power of theirs. That's the way God works here in Habakkuk. He's raising up an army that is unjust. He is raising up an army of injustice as a rod of judgment against a people who have tolerated and practiced injustice. In other words, he is going to challenge their continual appetite for injustice and lust for power by exposing them to degrees of injustice and by the means that they would never have imagined. So he says to them, "Look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded, for I am doing a work that you will not believe. It is the furthest thing from your mind." Friends, Habakkuk is simply looking at the world around him, and God is looking into the heart of those around him. And God says this, "Behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome, and their justice and dignity go forth from themselves." Did you hear that? They are just like Israel. They have concocted their own version of justice. God is giving them more of what they've been guilty of in order to break their appetite for what they've been guilty of. Habakkuk describes his own people as violent, destructive, and unjust. But God describes the Babylonians as drunken, arrogant, restless, greedy, and dissatisfied thieves. They are violent, and they appear to fear nothing and no one. He says of them that they are guilty men whose might is their God, verse 11. In other words, that which Habakkuk had feared most is actually coming upon him. So let me see if we can bring our own life into line more so with this context. What if Habakkuk lived today? Just 2 days before we cast our vote for midterm elections, like us, he's been looking around, taking notice of the mess that we live in. Many Christians in America are looking for God to act, looking for God to do something, looking for God to prove that He cares and that He can fix it. I have no doubt that's a sincere prayer. But what they're expecting, if God's going to be faithful to them, is for their party to triumph. They expect that when God acts, their political party will have control of the House and the Senate. They expect that if God acts, then go to bed a Tuesday night, wake up the next morning, and read all about the victory. I think that's the way that most Americans, American Christians, think about God's justice, goodness, and love. But in the infinite wisdom and love and justice of God, He may see fit to give the House and the Senate and the White House and the entire Supreme Court to a party that you fear and dread to have power over it. That's the message of Habakkuk. God, look at this mess. What are you going to do? And the answer, if you're a conservative, I'm going to give the House and the Senate and the White House and the Supreme Court to the liberals. And if you're a liberal, I'm going to give the House and the Senate and the White House and the Supreme Court to the conservatives. Now, I suspect that if God allowed that to happen, many, if not most of those who gathered to pray on Tuesday morning, They would be looking at Tuesday night's results as if God had nothing at all to do with it. The message of Habakkuk is here to show us that God did have something to do with that. It's stretching us. Now, if you can identify with this kind of potential darkness, then you understand Habakkuk. And you also understand the key verse. It's found in 2, verse 4. The righteous shall live by his faith, or literally his faithfulness. And it appears in a place in the book that teaches us that faith for the righteous is believing God even when he allows things to be very different than the way that we have planned. I don't mean to say that Christian life is one of spiritual optimism, or I don't mean to say that the Christian life is a fear of stating what is true and real. I mean believing God even when what we see would move us to wonder, does he care? And does, can he, will he, won't he intervene? I mean trusting God is who he says that he is, even if he allows the wicked to prevail for a moment. Point three, sometimes injustice gets a temporary victory. Habakkuk had no way to make sense of what he was seeing and what he knew to be true about God. The world that he saw made him weary, and his thoughts about God at that moment added just weariness to it. He couldn't understand what's going on. And the crucial question appears in just a few verses later, in verse 13. How can you remain silent, he says to God, when the wicked are swallowed up by those who are more righteous, swallow up those who are more righteous than they? The wicked swallow up the righteous, people who are more righteous than they. And God will reveal that sometimes he allows injustices to prevail. Though limited in its reach, limited in its purpose, limited in its length, God can and does bring about glorious good that way. And the question is, really? God brings about glorious good by temporarily allowing injustice to rule? Well, at times. At times. You can imagine in history, is there glorious good that comes about by God allowing the injustice of the Nazis to have their dominion for a while? Is there some kind of glorious good in our day when courts are hijacked by a guilty person walks because paperwork wasn't filed in exactly the same way? Does God really allow injustices to take place like that, as if some glorious good is going to recur if he does? But friends, I would ask you to dig even a little more deeply, even at a more sinister level. Let's consider that God sent his own Son into the world, and he was subjected to every form of injustice that there can be. People lied about him. People spread rumors about him. They drew conclusions about him before even giving him a fair hearing. He was arrested by men who were motivated completely by envy, who had no basis for the charges that they made against him. And so they hired people to lie about him publicly. They stirred up mobs and they threatened riot in order to manipulate the governors so that they would do what they pleased. He was publicly humiliated, and all of this was injustice. Friends, in a shame and honor culture, his family's name was shredded. He's put to death because he was a threat to the establishment, and it was a temporary victory for injustice. The cross shows us that the message of Habakkuk does not exist in isolation. But while Jesus was on that cross, as victimized by wicked men who were forcing their way and acting in injustice, Jesus hung on a cross and endured the true separation from God. It wasn't imagined. It was true. God turned his head from Jesus. And he did that so that you and I, who are in Christ, would never have to face a day, not a day, not a second, not a moment of time, when God is actually removed from us. Or in that moment where he's put on a cross by evil men, and in that moment, that perfect substitute for sin is now taking my place before God so that his wrath is no longer a target toward me. So that he pays for all of my sin, and he fulfills all the obligations of righteousness in a moment of temporary victory of injustice. And then, as he lay there dead in the grave for 3 days, he rose from the dead, putting an end to temporary triumph of the wicked, putting an end to the tyranny of injustice. I ask you, does God at times in his own sovereign way and for his own purposes allow the temporary victory of tyranny in order for ultimate goodness to take place? And the answer is yes, he does. We're going to look at Habakkuk as it points us to the cross of Christ. And in doing so, I think this book teaches us a great deal. Friends, it teaches us not to draw ultimate conclusions about God based on temporary realities. When temporary difficulties come, we all want to know why. What's the purpose exactly? And the answer, the honest answer, is I do not know. I know that God, a good God, is using those difficulties for your good. I do know that. But how exactly, I do not know. Habakkuk is going to teach us not to take counsel within ourselves, but rather take counsel in God. And for those that will actually do that, that actually begin gaining counsel from God, even in the midst of our troubles, we will find that we will have far less torment within our souls, if we will. Habakkuk is going to teach us that God is not disconcerned about the problems of this world, nor is he unable to deal with them. Habakkuk is going to teach us that all injustices will be righted in due time. It will teach us that this is his world, that he is not our servant, but he is our creator, sustainer, and redeemer. And this book will challenge our hearts to really taking this phrase seriously: the righteous shall live by faith. If you'll stand with me this morning, we'll prepare our hearts for the table. Because this, my friends, is the trajectory of our lives. I don't suspect there's anyone here that can't say, I've suffered from injustices of one sort or another. I don't suspect there's anyone here who would say, no, my life has just been peachy from first grade on. Just had one little moment in second grade, but they moved away and everything else has been great. Nobody has a story like that. Life is hard. Life for the Christian is difficult. Every scenario that comes along, God is not only working externally, but also internally. But Habakkuk is going to teach us that the righteous live by one way, by faith in God, trust in God. And the challenge for us, Christian, is do we know him? Do we know him? The leaders have come forward and prepare to serve us. We're looking at the elements here before us, the bread and the cup, and we're looking at those two elements that speak to us about the gospel itself. It speaks, they're visible elements of what was injustice turned to glorious good. And the table, among many things that it speaks to us about, it speaks of faith. It speaks to us to see that even though things can be temporarily really hard, there is a victory on the other side. It's a victory of grace. It's a victory of faith. And that victory is ours in Christ. Christ subjected to the wiles of the wicked temporarily to show us that God is not careless about justice. Your forgiveness, friends, is legal. You needed a substitute. God doesn't make little of justice. The table this morning reminds us of that truth. He's in it. He sees. He knows. He cares.